From Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. 50 years ago, the first Surgeon General's report on tobacco and health was released. Despite many strategies over the last half century to combat smoking and nicotine addiction, approximately 1 in 5 adult Americans, or about 45.3 million people, continue to smoke cigarettes. Half of smokers will die from tobacco-related illness. For every smoking-related death, another 20 persons will suffer from a smoking-related disease. Today, a discussion of smoking cessation, the consequences of smoking for the surgical patient, and the role of surgeons in counseling their patients who smoke. Up next on The Recovery Room.
Support for this episode of The Recovery Room comes from the American College of Surgeons.
Making sense of modern medicine. This is The Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. An estimated 10 million surgical procedures involving smokers are performed each year, and 30% of patients undergoing elective general surgery procedures smoke. The negative impact of smoking on surgical patients is considerable. Smoking cessation prior to surgery is associated with demonstrable benefits. Today, we'll explore the role of the surgeon in combating tobacco and nicotine abuse, and delve a little further into the consequences for surgical patients who continue to smoke. In the studio today is Dr. Eric Skipper, Chief of Adult Cardiothoracic Surgery at the Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, and by phone, Dr. Mike Rosen, Professor of Surgery and Chief of GI and General Surgery at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Welcome, Mike. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you very much.
So, Eric, let me start with you. You're a cardiothoracic surgeon. Obviously, we know the effect of smoking on many of the diseases that you deal with, but give me a little idea. You meet a person, they're either going to get a coronary bypass, they're going to get a valve done, they've been smoking a pack of cigarettes for 30 years. What do you say to that patient on the first meeting? How do you approach the whole idea of smoking?
Well, we come to grips with the idea that they have to stop. And fortunately, some of the groundwork starts with my nurse when they room the patient. But once I go in the room, we explain the true implications to the patient of what smoking means with regard to the surgery they need. And very quickly, we come to grips with the idea that they need to stop.
So it's a team effort. It really starts maybe in the lobby, the waiting area, the material that a patient first fills out, the history of the patient, the smoking history, and then you continue with that as when you see them.
Certainly. I mean, it absolutely is a team effort, but it also becomes part of that physician-patient interaction, that contract between the physician and the patient, where they come to grips with the idea that it truly does impact their health. And if they want to get better, it's something that has to change.
Now, obviously, patients come to you who clearly need an operation. They've had chest pain. They've had cardiac failure. They've had issues that really require surgery. So say somebody tells you, well, doctor, you know, I've been smoking for 30 to 40 years. It's unlikely that I'm going to stop smoking. Do you offer them an operation?
Not immediately. If it's an emergency situation, you do what you need to do for the patient. But if they're in the elective or urgent setting, we have another long talk. And patients will oftentimes see me on several occasions and hear the same story over and over until eventually they quit smoking. So I would say 99%+ of patients stop smoking at least for a period of time before surgery. Studies have shown that stopping for as little as 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time can impact your respiratory, your breathing mechanics after surgery. So I think it's very important.
So Mike Rosen, you're a general surgeon who deals a lot in really complex abdominal wall surgery, especially hernia surgery. You run the Hernia Center in Cleveland. If we talk to patients about smoking, what's the time frame that we should think about for patients to stop before we offer them a large operation like you would offer them?
Well, as Eric said, I think there are several advantages to quitting smoking, and certainly the longer you quit smoking, the better effects you're going to have and more of a benefit to quitting smoking. But I think that you can kind of break them up into short-term effects that occur around smoking cigarettes, and I think this would be decrease in blood flow, which obviously is important for healing any surgical incision, that can be reversed probably within a week or two. And then there's other effects like immune function, and in particular for what I do, which is healing and collagen production, which I think is really important for patients to understand. That's going to take a little bit longer. It can take somewhere between 4 to 6 weeks. And then some of the longer effects, some of the mucus production and the pulmonary effects of smoking, that can take up to 6 to 8 weeks. But I think, as Eric mentioned, clearly there's been benefit. Even quitting smoking for 2 to 3 weeks will help some things in the OR. It certainly doesn't make it worse. That's a common misconception. But I think, from my perspective, the longer patients quit, the better they feel and the better they recover from surgery.
So, Mike, we talked about the effect of healing tissue, and obviously that's important. What about wound infection rates? I mean, wound infections create an economic burden in this country. Does cigarette smoking increase wound infection rates in your particular group of patients?
So that's actually, certainly in my patients, we actually have published papers on this ourselves. It's actually the single biggest predictor of surgical site infections in hernia patients, but there's countless other, really some of the best literature that we have of randomized controlled trials. Even recently, there was a meta-analysis with 500,000 patients looking at almost 150 studies. And essentially, if you look at every wound infection and surgical site event, was significantly higher in those patients that smoked. So clearly, there is a abundance of scientific evidence that it helps. I think the key is getting that message and that information to patients in a way that they can understand that.
Eric, what about the cardiothoracic patient? It's a devastating thing to have a sternal wound infection. Do we see an increase in patients who continue to smoke?
Well, we certainly see an increase in their risk profile for all major morbidities if they smoke. With respect to wound healing, oftentimes it's a secondary issue with regard to infections. So patients that smoke up until the time of surgery tend to cough more, puts more stress on their healing of their breastbone, can loosen things, can cause wound weepage, and then secondarily it gets infected. This can be a very devastating problem for the patient. Fortunately, we don't leave a lot of artificial material in, so that helps to some extent, but clearly, these people do not do as well if they smoke up until the time of surgery.
So let's turn our attention for a moment to nicotine replacement. You know, this is a big thing now. We'll talk about maybe electronic cigarettes in a moment, get your thoughts on that. But Eric, in your field, a patient says, yes, Dr. Skipper, I'm really excited about this. I'm ready to stop, but you got to help me. And, you know, what can you give me to help me with this? I've tried 100 times, you know. Can you help me with it?
Well, I think certainly everything's on the table to try to get the patient off cigarettes. If nicotine is the addictive factor, so oftentimes we'll resort to nicotine patches. It's nice in that it gets rid of the inhalation effect of the cigarettes, gives the lungs a break, but it also reduces their withdrawal from the nicotine. Typically, we'll start with a moderate patch and then wean them off over a couple of weeks. Many patients, though, really will stop cold turkey. They will just decide that this is the right thing for their body, and they'll do it. But we try to put every option on the table, and that can span from acupuncture, acupressure on one side of the table to medications on the other side.
Well, there was some data some years ago, especially in the cardiothoracic world, that patients who were smoking and they did cold turkey maybe had their lung function actually was worse after an operation, and maybe they should continue to smoke. Any thoughts on that?
Well, they shouldn't continue to smoke. Smokers they're addicted. It is a very severe addiction, and many people want to blame everything else for their problem, but you continually have to refocus the patient back to the fact that you got to quit smoking. And I don't think any studies have ever really shown that there are bad effects from stopping.
So, Mike, you mentioned the effect of blood flow. I mean, especially in somebody with a complex abdominal wall process like you operate on, doesn't nicotine cause the same problems that a cigarette would? Wouldn't you expect problems from any nicotine replacement in a complex abdominal wall hernia procedure?
So, interestingly, that was a common misconception that I had several years ago. and really thought that any form of nicotine replacement was going to be bad. But this actually has been studied, and there's no question that it improves quitting for patients to accomplish that. However, it's been looked at in several different venues, and it appears that it doesn't cause any of those side effects of impaired wound healing. So in my practice, it's interesting. I appreciate what Eric said. I actually try and get patients to quit cold turkey as hard as I can, and a lot of it comes in the delivery and the buy-in and all the teamwork that you guys have already spoken to. And I would agree that the vast majority of patients, when given the appropriate carrot and perhaps the stick of surgery, are able to get motivated and quit. But certainly those that can't and come back and continually fail, I do think that nicotine replacement therapy is helpful. Certainly, I think you can operate while they're on it, but ideally it's a bridge to completely quitting, and that, I think, is probably the best approach for that.
So, Mike, how successful are we if we get a patient on a nicotine product of some sort? How successful are we that after the operation, they'll continue to abstain?
You know, I think that's a totally different group of patients. And I think once they've had their surgery, they've recovered, it's easy to get back to their old habit. And I think that the rates are probably reasonably high. Although, again, to me, this all comes down to what is a teachable moment. And I think that one of the most important things that surgeons need to impart on their patients, particularly for what I do, is that this is a lifetime problem when you have a hernia. And if you smoke, a year from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, this will break down. So this is not going to work if you don't stay a part of the team and success. And I think that in my experience, I would probably say half the patients go back to smoking, but that, again, means half were able to quit, and actually not just for the operation, but long term.
So, Eric, we talked about the initial meeting with the patient. I guess the question is, once you've operated on, you've done a CABG, you've done a valve on a patient, you've done a thoracic procedure, what's the role of the surgeon then in assuring that potentially smoking would cease? What is your approach when you see a patient post-op?
Well, I think you should continue to reinforce positive behaviors. So I try to note it at a very visible location in my medical record so that when the patient comes back, I can ask them how they're doing with their smoking cessation. The patients who continued to not smoke are actually some of the, they're very proud. They're the most proud patients you'll take care of. They're proud of themselves for breaking the habit. And I think as physicians, we have to be a little empathetic and understanding to the patients. I mean, these people have an addiction, and you have to continually reinforce good behavior to keep them from relapsing and going back to the old behaviors. It's no different than anybody with any other addiction. It's very easy to go back. So anything we can do to positively reinforce that smoking cessation is key.
That's very interesting because, again, we know that patients may not be truthful sometimes with their surgeon. So, Mike, what is the role of some testing? Are there tests that should be done to see if nicotine is in the system before you operate? And do you use those tests?
So there are tests. There are tests. You can get a serum creatinine level. You can test for carbon monoxide levels. There's another test, a carbohydrate deficient transferrin test you can get. But the simplest test is a serum creatinine test. At our hospital, it is a send-out, so it certainly can't be done the same day. In my practice, we tell all patients that we are going to test them, and we have very strict rules that if it comes back as positive, their elective hernia operation will be canceled for 6 months. I think in full disclosure, a lot of patients come back and they're so excited that they quit, and you can clearly tell that we won't do that. But if there's any question at all and we're concerned about it, we will check a serum creatinine level and just confirm that they have quit smoking.
Eric, what's your approach to testing for nicotine?
Day in and day out, we don't routinely test. I think Mike should be applauded for his ability to do that. I think in the average practice of medicine out there, there's probably an overall lack of testing. The one venue in which we do test is in the transplant arena, because how patients do after transplant is so key to these behaviors that one of the things that will rule you out for transplant is continued smoking. So we do test routinely there.
Mike, I know you've developed some interesting strategies, and I've heard you talk on this and what you tell the patients. It's almost like a grading system. It's like a contract that you develop with them. Could you just sort of explain that to our listeners, what you really tell a patient about the plan for their surgery?
Sure. I think, and really this starts right when they walk into my office, much like what Eric described, and it's essentially a culture that we will not tolerate that behavior, and it's part of our preoperative optimization for patients. And so in my own practice, the way I like to describe it to patients is there's no magic in Cleveland, and there's good results will be obtained through team effort, where when I come to the OR, I only promise you absolutely 100% effort in everything I do. And from this moment forward, my expectation will be from you to perform the same. And the next step we take is there's really only two things in my venue that really affect outcomes that patients control, and that's obesity and smoking. And we tackle each one of those, and we set goals. And I really try and describe to patients that, especially for complex hernia repair, what I'm relying on is wound healing for it to work. And the reason that they had to come see me and the reason that it hasn't worked the past 10 times is that things haven't been able to heal, and we can't continue to smoke and prevent healing. And it's not negotiable. And we're going to follow up. We're going to check. I typically will see them back within 6 weeks to 2 months to confirm and have another conversation. And then we will eventually schedule surgery. But our first visit, there's no discussion of the operation at all. Zero. In fact, if they ask, we won't address it because we focus on the fact that they're not ready to talk about surgery because of some of the choices and the situations and the addictions and the problems that we have. And that kind of sets the tone, essentially, that we mean business. And Eric said that the vast majority of patients, when they understand the situation, they understand what's at risk, have enough intestinal fortitude to fight it off and beat it. And one other point I'll make is it is a big struggle and a lot of effort for the surgeons to do this, but I get more enjoyment seeing patients come back a year later who quit smoking, who are so happy, so proud, so thankful that somebody got them to do it, that I am empowered to fight the fight with the next patient, no matter how hopeless it seems.
So really, you're talking about almost a contract with a patient. Eric, is that what you do when you talk about informed consent? Do we really deal with a contractual thing about smoking and how important it is?
Well, I think if smoking doesn't come up in the informed consent discussion, then you haven't really gotten informed consent. It really is a contract. And, you know, you're promising that you're going to take care of the patient. This is your end of the contract. But you, as Mike said, need them to fulfill theirs. Occasionally, patients will ask, how often am I going to have to come back and have the smoking discussion? There's a standard answer from my nurse and my staff in my office, and that is as long as it takes for you to quit smoking. I think that's the message. Patients hear that loud and clear, and they understand that you're on their side, that you're actually fighting for them, but you need their help.
One of the things we're trying to foster through the American College of Surgeons is the concept that surgeons have to play a role in smoking cessation. So both of you are involved in training future surgeons. Do you feel that the young trainee is learning about this? Are they learning anything about how to approach a patient about smoking cessation? And Mike, let me start with you.
Well, I think they are. I certainly think, you know, in residency programs and large centers, it's clear that you see the consequences of smoking, and particularly in surgical practices. I think learning how to speak with patients is something that you learn through clinic, and I think there's surgeons that have varying skills of being able to do that. Certainly in my training, it's interesting different people's character in clinic and how they handle things, and you take little tidbits. I don't think there's a focused path of how to do it. I've certainly had countless residents with their iPhones record my conversation with the patient and the way we talk about smoking to take it on to their practice. My last chief resident went into vascular surgery. Obviously, it's another strong area of smoking and that struggle. So I think that there's little islands of it, but certainly concerted effort and getting people to focus on it makes a lot of sense to me.
How about Eric, with the cardiothoracic resident? Are we teaching them how to approach this?
I think we're teaching them how to approach patients with more evidence-based care, and this is part of it. You're trained today to evaluate risk versus benefit, and it comes into everything we do in cardiothoracic surgery. What's the relative risk for the patient if you do this versus that? Did you use this risk score calculation versus that risk score calculation? And in many ways, it truly benefits the patient, but it also forces these new trainees in medicine to become very adept when most of us who are on the air trained, we didn't have a lot of that. It was word of mouth. It was, this physician did it really well. This one did a lousy job, much like Mike said. But today, I think it has become the norm. Patients expect the best quality and the best outcomes. And it's up to us as physicians to try to help them get those.
I don't want to end our conversation today without asking you gentlemen about your thoughts about electronic cigarettes. We've been inundated in the media about whether this is really a good or bad. Is it a bridge? Is it something that is going to help patients? Clearly, it has nicotine in it. So, Eric, your thoughts, is this something you'd even bring up in discussion about the electronic cigarette?
It comes up. I don't bring it up, but it comes up. And I think in general, it's a bad idea. I like nicotine patches because they're a bridge to getting patients off cigarettes. But electronic cigarettes, you're inhaling nicotine and several other agents, flavoring agents, various chemicals that are in the concoction. And these are things that people use to bridge their addiction to another addiction. So we really don't have 20-year data on these devices. But there's no question that inhaling nicotine into your body every day is a bad idea. It's a bad idea to chew nicotine gum every day for the next 20 years. So I think electronic cigarettes are in general a bad idea, and I discourage their use.
Mike, what is your feeling on electronic cigarettes?
I would 100% agree with Eric. I think it's interesting because one of the key things is their regulation pathway by the FDA is not entirely clear and is certainly not to the standard of a regular cigarette where you really know what's in it, you know the nicotine levels. There's a lot of variability. There's a wide spectrum. And I think that it is very easy to market it as a safe alternative to smoking, but certainly for wound healing events, collagen issues, blood flow issues, the levels of all the other substrates that are in it, I think that from a scientific perspective, the fairest answer to say is the jury's out, but I have grave concerns that it is not going to be a safe alternative.
Mike, any final thoughts about your approach to smoking cessation and what the surgeon's role is in this?
You know, this is one area that you can have such a major impact as a surgeon on patients' lives well beyond the operation that they're going to have. And I think it's an extremely rewarding endeavor for long-term benefits to patients that I feel would be one thing. And I think the other thing is just to realize that this is a moment where you can get a patient to understand that they have a responsibility for their outcome. And it's important that they accept that responsibility and they accept their role in the team, and that really the only way to get true success and true quality outcomes is everybody on the team performing at a high level. And I think that's another important teachable moment for patients to understand as we move forward in healthcare and really carefully look at quality outcomes, that everybody's invested in that outcome.
Eric, your final thoughts on smoking cessation?
I agree with Mike. I think everybody is invested in the patient's outcome. Patients do really appreciate your interest in their longevity and how well they do with their surgery. I think the most important thing is really to let patients know that you really do care about them. And as Mike said, they're doing a holistic approach to patients that come into their hernia center. They're not just focusing on the hernia. And in reality, that's what's going to benefit the patient in the long run.
Today on The Recovery Room, we've been talking about smoking cessation and the role of the surgeon in achieving smoking cessation, especially in the patient who's being operated on. We've been talking with Dr. Eric Skipper, a cardiothoracic surgeon from Charlotte, North Carolina, and Dr. Mike Rosen, a general surgeon doing complex hernia surgery at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Eric, Mike, thank you very much for being on The Recovery Room.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
The Recovery Room is supported by the American College of Surgeons. The producer is Tina Simmons. Technical support provided by Jim Losby. Find us on the web at facs.org/recoveryroom.